Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, a Radio Free Europe podcast on developments in Russia, its war against Ukraine, and its relations with the rest of the world. I'm Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL, and author of The Week in Russia newsletter. 25 years ago tomorrow, on the last day of 1999, Russian President Boris Yeltsin announced that he was stepping down and making Vladimir Putin the acting president of Russia. Putin had not been well known at all until he became prime minister that August of 1999, and then became the face of Russia's brutal second war in the Chechnya region. And in March of 2000, Putin was duly elected president, and he has been president or prime minister ever since. Arguably, he was also in charge when he stepped back into the number two role as prime minister for 4 years in 2008 performed the so-called castling maneuver with Dmitry Medvedev, who was president for those 4 years. In any case, Putin returned to the presidency in 2012 and then changed the constitution in 2020 to allow himself to remain in the Kremlin potentially until 2036, which is still quite far away. Joining me to talk about Putin's quarter century in power is Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies, and the author of several books, including Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine, and most recently, Forged in War, A Military History of Russia from Its Beginnings to the Present. Mark is also co-author with Anna Arutunyan of Downfall, Prigozhin, Putin, and the New Fight for the Future of Russia. Mark, thanks very much for joining me for the final episode of this podcast in 2024.
Always a pleasure, though it has to be said, well, one quarter of a century in power, that is a rather telling milestone.
Absolutely. I was just noting the title of your book, Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine. Those kind of bookend it, at least for now, with some momentous decisions that were made at the very beginning of Putin's, when he was still rising to power, and of course, in 2022. So thanks very much. Great to speak to you again, Mark. To start this out, I'm going to borrow a question that Steve Rosenberg of the BBC asked Putin at his marathon Q&A event in Moscow earlier this month. Rosenberg said that Yeltsin told Putin when he handed over the reins to him, told Putin to protect Russia or take care of Russia would be another translation. And the reporter asked Putin at that Q&A session whether he had done that. I'll just mention that this was, I believe, one of the last questions that Putin took. So presumably the Kremlin wanted his answer to be seen as important. And Putin answered that he had not only, in his view, he had not only protected Russia, but had pulled it back from the edge of the abyss. Predictably, because he said it before, saying that when he came to power, Russia was on the verge of losing its sovereignty. And of course, he has very often spoke of sovereignty and its importance in his mind. Or at least. Mark, what do you think? Has Putin protected Russia, taking care of it?
Well, before I start, it's always worth having a little quick shout out to Steve Rosenberg of the BBC. It's amazing that he's still there and still able to actually do a proper journalist's job. And it says something, it's worth noting also, about the fact that Russia itself does not want to totally North Koreanize itself. There is still that sense that it needs certain connections to the outside world. Anyway, talking about Putin and has he protected Russia, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to jump onto one of my hobby horses, which is to draw parallels between Putin and Tsar Ivan IV, Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Terrible. because I do think it's actually quite interesting that the degree to which there are certain commonalities. You know, both of them had rough childhoods. In the case of Ivan, his father died when he was, from memory, 3. His mother, when I think he was 8, probably poisoned. So there was this period of regency in which essentially Ivan was a figurehead, while powerful boyars squabbled over power, and Ivan himself sort of recounts having to scavenge for scraps from the kitchen to eat and so forth. And this led to a lifelong, constant and frankly pathological quest for security, which became self-destructive in due course. And it particularly manifests itself because one can divide Ivan's reign into two halves. The first half, I mean, obviously was every bit as murderous as one would expect from a medieval Russian monarch, but was also a period of genuine state building. In terms of domestic policy, this is a period of, you know, a grand council that's basically codified the laws, and there's also another one that looked at the relationship between church and state. You had the creation of the kind of proto-structures of Russian bureaucracy that survived to the present day. You know, if you look at the histories of the current Russian foreign ministry, it dates itself back to the ambassador's office that Ivan created. Likewise, the banditry office is the precursor of today's interior ministry. And the streltsy, the sort of musketeers, was the first standing army. So, you know, the very bases of a genuine institutionalized Russian state were formed then. And you also had foreign policy successes. You had peace deals with Lithuania, that was one of the great military powers of the age. You had the successful conquest of the Kazan Khanate, Kazan, which after all had been constantly raiding Russia, as largely for slaves, frankly. So this is a period of considerable success. But over time, Ivan became increasingly paranoid, increasingly intolerant, increasingly turned against his own boyars, his own aristocrats. And in his paranoias, he ended up creating the oprichnina, almost a state within a state. His private henchmen, the oprichniki, raided and plundered across the country. He killed his own heir in a fit of anger. And when he died, it led to this whole period called the Time of Troubles, a succession of dynastic, political, cultural, economic crises that really did rip across the country until the new Romanov dynasty was raised. Now, apologies for the encapsulated history lesson, but to draw the parallels with Putin, if one looks at early Putin, his first two presidencies, yes, there was the murderous war in Chechnya, one has to accept. Though, you know, often, frankly, states will use rather extreme tactics to maintain their integrity, not that that excuses the human rights abuses and the like. But more broadly, Putin's claim to have dragged the country back from the abyss has some, and I'd underline some, validity. You know, if one looks at the 1990s, it was a period of crisis. Now, Putin himself was phenomenally lucky. He was lucky in that those first two terms, he had money to spare because of changes in global hydrocarbon prices, and suddenly there was money in the treasury. The violent gang wars, which had ripped across Russia in the 1990s, had anyway already been subsiding in the late parts of that decade. The turf lines had been established, the pecking orders and so forth. People were generally tired of the anarchy and drift, and therefore, in some ways, Putin was more the beneficiary rather than the creator of the subsequent period of stability and indeed prosperity. But nonetheless, if nothing else, he was the steward over that. So, I mean, actually, in some ways, one can talk about the first two Putin terms as being actually strikingly successful. However, what we have seen since his return from his sort of period of temporary puppeteer behind the scenes prime minister is that he very soon essentially declared war on his own middle class, increasingly became intolerant of not just opposition, but also alternative perspectives. Hence the narrowing of his circle, the exclusion of people who had expertise and insights that he needed. And very soon you have, well, with the 2014 annexation of Crimea and then the intervention involvement in the Donbass, essentially the start of a first undeclared war that was then eventually slide to full-scale war. So I think in all these circumstances, one can say that his first two terms were periods in which he did actually, again, how far it's, he just didn't do anything to stop it. But nonetheless, he presided over a period of genuine growth and prosperity and stability and institution building, in which actually Russia did regain a certain amount of sovereignty. Not that I think he'd have lost as much as he claims. But increasingly, since his return to the presidency, he has been burning through all those gains, all those assets. And this is part of the tragedy of Putin, that like Ivan, he was a state builder at first and increasingly has been a state breaker. Now, I don't think that Putin's eventual death or whatever is going to lead to a new time of troubles. The times are different. History is not an exact guide. But nonetheless, I do think that is the kind of judgment that history will have on him. So very long answer to a short question. Has Russia been taken care of by Putin for a while? But then Putin in some ways decided that his own hubris, his own ambitions were more important than the interests of his country. And since then, he has definitely not been a good steward.
Thanks very much, Mark. No, it's great to have a comprehensive kind of history of Ivan the Terrible. It's an interesting analogy. I'm going to preface my second question by mentioning something that strikes me, I guess, in terms of Putin's argument that he has protected Russia, taken care of Russia, and some of the decisions he's made that, in my mind, point in the opposite direction. One is that, well, I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, the war on Ukraine, but I just want to, a big decision, obviously, was his decision to return to the Kremlin in 2012. And to me, it just, I mean, he made excuses, essentially. He was angry about Libya and things like that. And then in 2020, changes the constitution. I mean, it's obviously he pushed through these changes to allow him, nobody else but him, to run for, basically to run for two more terms starting earlier this year. So, I mean, to me, just those decisions are arguments against the idea that he successfully protected Russia or was doing so, because he seems to have, you know, if he had successfully done that, why would he need to return? It seems like the best proof of I have saved Russia would be, and now I'm going to put it in someone else's hands. And in fact, he's said repeatedly in the past, although maybe not so much lately, that other people, there were plenty of other people, you know, who could rule. Although when it comes to crunch time, he then decides that he needs to rule. So I just wanted to mention that. But my second question, I will try to keep this brief. Did Russia under Putin have to become the way it is now, or could things have been different? And number two, could you name one or two of, or three, a couple of turning points over the past 25 years, kind of watershed moments, decisions by Putin or outside influences that shaped his rule and shaped the years to come?
Well, I mean, first of all, of course, Russia could have been different, even with Putin being in the Kremlin. There are always different sort of turning points. There are always issues on which history hinges. For example, I mean, you know, as you mentioned, it seems quite clear that at the beginning of the castling process, when Putin receded to become prime minister, albeit an overpowered prime minister facing an underpowered president, but it does seem to be that he was genuinely toying with the idea of not returning to office. And frankly, as I say, I think, you know, history would have treated him rather differently if he had done so. It was only that he then became convinced that he was indeed essential. that only he could pilot, you know, for all his words about other people, only he was the indispensable man that actually sort of brought him to this great act of hubris and returning. So, you know, one can note there are all sorts of different decision points. I'm always leery of the kind of deterministic history that says, well, because this thing, then that was inevitable. History happens. There are all sorts of different contingent factors. And to be perfectly honest, in many ways, the pattern had actually already been set in the 1990s by the fact that Boris Yeltsin was a very, very effective destroyer. You know, when he was focused and effective, when he had an enemy, a target, whether that was a Communist Party, whether that was Gorbachev, whatever. But when he had freedom of operation, when he had won, he didn't really have any notion of the kind of Russia he wanted to create. He had a few broad senses of, oh, it should be democracy, but the right kind of democracy. It should be the market, but the right kind of market. But essentially, he was no state builder. And that helped contribute to this sense of anarchy and drift, this demeaning of the notion of democracy that people very quickly sort of associated it with the miseries of their lives. And also, you know, we have to recognize the failures of the West as well in its policies in the 1990s. It's not to say, oh, well, it was the West's fault or anything like that. But we have to recognize that when we allowed Yeltsin to get away with shelling his own parliament in violation of the Constitution and essentially rigging the 1996 elections, then we also contributed to the undermining of those forces that genuinely wanted to create democracy, a working democracy in those years. So in some ways, it was much more likely that there would be someone like Putin taking over, you know, a revanchist, strongman, statist figure. But of course, there were different flavors of Putin, shall we say, that could have come to power. But in terms of actually the sort of key turning points, I'll give you three. One of them may sound a little sort of paradoxically small scale. In 2010, President, as he was still then, Medvedev, visited the Kuril Islands, which is this contested territories between Russia and Japan. The Japanese call them the Northern Territories. And this provoked a furious response from Tokyo, diplomatic spat, as I recall. They withdrew their ambassador for a while and that kind of thing. And why this mattered is that this was essentially a visit that was more than anything else about security and geopolitics. And it was a chance for Medvedev to look tough, to stare the Japanese down and such like. Symbolic, but symbolism matters in politics. And for me, I think this was one of the crucial turning points in deciding Putin on his return to the Kremlin. Because after all, whatever Medvedev himself may have been thinking or planning, there clearly was a constituency within his own support base who wanted him to stand again, to actually contest an election with Putin. And they were clearly pushing him, and they managed to get him to start metaphorically placing his tanks on Putin's lawn, to start talking much more about issues of security and geopolitics that up to that point had been really regarded as reserved Putin topics. And I think this is something that in some ways decided finally to tip Putin off the sort of the seesaw. And he decided, no, I'm going to stand again. Medvedev is challenging me. He's not the right man. He was weak during the 2008 invasion of Georgia, the crisis over that, when basically I had to ring him up from Beijing to push him into acting against the Georgians. And now he's trying to challenge me on security issues. No, that's not going to happen. We should never underestimate the importance of ego in making decisions for politicians. So that's turning point number one. So Putin returns. Then we have the 2011-2012 Bolotnaya protests. Natural, organic protests from above all, but not exclusively, the sort of the new emerging middle class of Moscow and St. Petersburg. Angry at the sense that elections can be so clearly rigged and that the presidency can seem to be just some bauble that is handed from Putin to Medvedev and from Medvedev back to Putin, as if they have some kind of God-given right to control it. Now, this was a genuine organic protest, But, of course, to Putin, in his rather paranoid worldview, in which it's the West, the CIA and MI6, who have all these secret political technologies that allow them to topple governments, Arab Spring, colored revolutions and such like. This is a sign that they are finally coming for him. And remember, when he talked about the Bolotnaya protests, he actually talked about Hillary Clinton, the then US Secretary of State, as having given a signal. And the protesters responded. So in other words, the idea that the Americans had actually just initiated the whole thing. And I think, particularly in hindsight, this is the point where Putin moved into a wartime footing. So at the crucial moment, and again, let me throw in another historical parallel. It's like the Decembrist rising against Nicholas I. You know, he comes to power. Nicholas I comes to power in the middle of an attempted coup by liberals. And from that point onwards, although he's aware that Russia needs reform, he never quite dares bring it about because he's worried about the potential instability. Well, likewise, I think from this point onwards, Putin is constantly feeling that he is assailed and that therefore he has to respond. Now, again, this is not in any way to exonerate him from the ghastly things he's done. It's to try and understand why from that point onwards he's increasingly aggressive towards the West, intolerant of any protests at home because he regards that as kind of fifth column activity instigated by the West, and increasingly on a collision course. And then the third turning point, very close by, again, they're all quite clustered. 2014, the Maidan, the revolution of dignity in Ukraine. Now, Putin's views on Ukraine have not changed. I mean, for a long time, he has been of the view that essentially Ukraine is part of Russia's political, cultural, historical patrimony. That may be Western Ukraine, perhaps is really, you know, a part of Poland or whatever. But certainly Eastern Ukraine is really a part of Russia that sort of lost its way at some point in history and certainly cannot be allowed to, as he would see it, be lost to Moscow. So when this happens, again, when viewed through his own conspiratorial, paranoid worldview, again, he couldn't believe that this was just a genuine response to a deeply corrupt government, which had just made an incredibly unpopular decision to sort of make a volte-face on its moves towards closer integration with the European Union. No, he had to see this as a coup d'etat engineered by those sinister political technologists in the West. And again, it was a sign from his point of view that the West was coming after him. I mean, his constant talk about the Western threat, in part it's political rhetoric, but it also reflects, I think, a genuine, wrong, muddle-headed, but nonetheless a genuine belief that he is on the defense. And that leads to the Crimean annexation. And the Crimean annexation indirectly leads to him sort of being drawn into what's going on in the Donbass. It was never part of the original plan, I don't think. But nonetheless, after a certain point, he feels, well, we need to be intervening in the Donbass in order to put pressure on Kyiv. That doesn't work, but now he's stuck in the Donbass. And in due course, that leads to this slide towards war in February 2022. Again, it's important to stress, none of it is foreordained. It's not as if he couldn't actually have changed his policies at different times. But this is, I think, the sort of trajectory he was on. This increasingly suspicious, increasingly paranoid sense that not only does he face threats at home, and again, this is the Ivan the Terrible moment. He cannot trust his own boyars. He cannot trust his own people, you know. But also that he faces a constant challenge from without, who will use, whether it's Ukraine or whether it's protests at home, in order to topple him and maybe even fragment the whole Russian Federation. So, you know, although aesthetically, shall we say, it will be nice to be able to find turning points that are more evenly spaced through this 25-year span. In some ways, I think precisely this whole notion of early and late Putinism fits the fact that, for me, the three key turning points are 2010, 2011, 2012, and 2014.
Thanks very much, Mark. Very, very interesting. And so essentially it's like three points at which he felt threatened, once by Medvedev and then twice by what he saw as he saw as Western interference, I guess. And he, of course, he had also been railing against the West long before that, you know, again, after Beslan and the other terrorist attacks in 2004. But interesting turning points. I'm just going to try to wrap up by asking kind of a follow-up question that gets into the war in Ukraine and the future of that, if you don't mind. You know, some analysts say that, you know, amid all this talk about whether there will be, you know, peace talks or ceasefire talks with Donald Trump coming into the White House in a few weeks, you know, some analysts say that Putin will not stop the war unless he essentially feels that he is threatened, that his regime or his presidency, his government is threatened, and that otherwise he will continue to try to achieve his goals and not, you know, maybe agree to a ceasefire if he thinks it can give him a chance to regroup and attack again, but not actually end the war. What do you think about that, if you don't mind responding?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I mean, let me make a general point that actually fits to what you were saying before about Putin being threatened in each of those key turning points. Unfortunately, his natural default response when threatened is to move on to the attack. And this goes back to, you know, he talked about this lesson he learned in his childhood when he was running the street gangs in the still rubbled ruins of Leningrad, that if you think you're going to get into a fight, you throw the first punch. So I think this has always been his instinct, is to throw the first punch with often catastrophic results. So to moving on to the issue of peace, I'm not sure. I mean, look, it's very difficult to try and crawl into the deep, dark recesses of Putin's brain. And it's not just about knowing, you might say, how he thinks. It's also about knowing how he interprets particular situations. You know, we can say, oh, he's burning through the muscle mass of the Russian economy. He's increasingly making Russia a vassal of China's. He's taking more losses than he's able to recruit at the moment in Ukraine. This is not sustainable in the long term, etc. It's very hard to know if that's how Putin sees things, because clearly he's not going to come out and say so. But nonetheless, I would say it's not necessarily that he'll only end the war if he feels he is threatened. I think it's that it's going to be very hard for him to bring himself to end the war if he thinks he's winning. There's a difference, after all, between not winning and being threatened. Mm-hmm. And I think this is the problem. At the moment, he's been sounding very, very cocky about the war, with a little bit of reason, in that his troops are advancing in both the Donbass and the Kursk regions, admittedly slowly and at massive cost. But, you know, presumably from his point of view, that's fine, because momentum is in their direction. And also, you know, there are all kinds of serious challenges facing Ukraine, whether it's in terms of quite what Donald Trump will mean, and none of us really know, or whether it's in terms of just the inability at the moment to recruit enough troops, given that for large, well, both political and demographic reasons, Zelensky is unwilling to actually bring down the lowest age and recruitment down to 18-year-olds. So I think in all these circumstances, at the moment he feels confident, and therefore he may well feel that there's no point in any kind of long-term resolution if he can, you know, 6 months more or 12 months more fighting and he'll be in an even better position. Now, of course, that is the classic one more push sort of rationale that so often has bedeviled, well, Russia and other countries, that they don't make peace when they really should, because they have this vision that, oh, just over the horizon, there's an even better position. I think that when it comes down to it, I can see, despite their own, what they're saying at the moment, I can see the Russians seeing the advantage in a ceasefire, because although they say, oh, the Ukrainians would benefit more from that, I'm not convinced that they necessarily believe that. I think that, again, the moment, the way they're burning through troops, I don't think they are themselves planning on being able to try and maintain this current tempo of operations in the long term. A ceasefire will give them all kind of opportunities, but above all, a ceasefire gives them the initiative, because if there is a ceasefire, it's highly unlikely that it will be Kyiv that breaks that, both because of the realities of the situation on the ground, but also on the risk of then alienating the Trump administration. But on the other hand, Putin can then essentially decide, whether it's after a day or a week or a month or a year, to reinitiate hostilities whenever he thinks that the circumstances are to his own advantage. So, you know, I could see him, for tactical reasons, agreeing a ceasefire and then banking that and then maybe just dragging out any subsequent negotiations and allowing the sort of the battle lines to freeze, or which is, after all, what the Ukrainians fear, or actually just simply using it as an opportunity to regroup and then relaunching offensives. If Ukraine does not have proper security guarantees baked into the process, then a ceasefire, frankly, is just an invitation to a constant period in which they never know whether today or tomorrow is the day when Putin's going to relaunch his war of sort of imperial oppression.
Okay, thank you, Mark. That is, I guess, I often say chilling. It is chilling. We're going to wrap it up here. We'll certainly see what happens in 2025 coming up in a couple days. Mark, very much appreciate you being here, and thanks very much for joining me.
Well, my pleasure. And despite everything else, I wish you and all the listeners happy and peaceful 2025.
Absolutely. Thanks for that. Once again, I've been speaking to Mark Galeotti, an analyst of Russian politics, an honorary professor at the UCL School of Slavonic and East European Studies, and the author of several books, including Putin's Wars from Chechnya to Ukraine and Forged in War, A Military History of Russia from Its Beginnings to the Present. And my name is Steve Gutterman, editor for Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in the Central Newsroom at RFERL. This has been The Week Ahead in Russia. Our theme music is Nye Strelyai, or Don't Shoot, a song from the early 1980s by Yuri Shevchuk and DDT. Please be sure to check out my newsletter, The Week in Russia, which covers the latest developments in Russian politics and society, as well as Moscow's invasion of Ukraine. Subscribe by visiting www.rferl.org.